You're listening to The Point. Chuck McDermott is a singer-songwriter whose career has spanned 40 years, touring with his own band and with the legendary folk artist Jon Stewart. In addition to a career as a musician, he spent 3 decades in politics and is a self-described environmentalist. He released his 3rd album, Gin and Rosewater, this past May, and he'll be performing on the Cape later this month. Chuck McDermott, welcome. Good
well,
to see you.
Well, thank you, Mindy. Great to be here.
So you formed your band Wheat Straw back in 1971, and
right.
In the 1980s, you spent some time in politics, founding the country's first electric power marketing company. You managed 2 congressional campaigns, served as a congressional chief of staff, ran the government affairs office for a multinational environmental services company, and CEO of a Boston-based energy and financial services company. You didn't have a lot of time for music full-time in that span. So you have done quite a bit of living between the time you first started your music career and the release of your most recent album. So how do you think your perspective changed over the decades, and how did it influence your music?
That's a great question, I think. So I've played guitar since I was 9, and I was always in bands and things like that. But I really got serious about it in my college days, and to the point where I didn't really finish. I got through 2 years, and I took what was to be a year off to play music and get it out of my system. And, you know, 14 years later, I actually set the guitar down, at least for a little while. But so I wrote a lot of songs during the decade of my 20s, and then with the band I had, Wheat Straw, based here in the Boston area. And they were tailored to what we were doing. We were performing a lot, and I had made a decision then, after playing in a lot of bands like most of us who came of age during the Beatle era, mm-hmm. and that whole renaissance of music in the 60s and 70s, we played a lot of everybody's songs. Like my early bands played the Beatles and the Byrds, and then Poco and Buffalo Springfield, mm-hmm. and artists like that. And when I started doing it for a living, I made a decision to, I really wanted to learn an idiom in depth. And blues was very popular in Boston, and there was the James Montgomery mm-hmm. Blues Band and people like that, and the Room Full of Blues and wonderful musicians. And as a guitarist, the blues was a lot of fun to play, but I was convincing no one I was a blues man. I'm originally from Iowa, and country music was in the air when I was a kid, and I got really drawn back into hardcore country music, so the music of Hank Williams and early Merle Haggard and stuff like that. So I was writing towards those kinds of themes. And we were playing country joints and honky-tonks, mm. and so there was a lot of that in it. Now, when you fast forward 40 years or so to the present time, you know, there's been a lot of living. You know, I have 3 grown children. I was married and divorced. I'm now about to remarry on New Year's Eve. And I've worked in nonprofits. I've worked in government. I've been involved in energy and environmental issues for 30 plus years. And all those things show up. You know, I've lost both my parents. So all of that ends up in your music. And you look at a lot of artists whom, in my case, that I admire, and how prolific and profound even they were writing in their 20s. Mm. And this is true of painters and dancers and other art forms. But so there is something that happens in that decade of one's life oftentimes. But I feel I've got so much more to draw on now than I did back then, that I'm really enjoying writing music now in a deeper way.
Yeah. You played for a number of years with Jon Stewart. For those not familiar with Jon, he was a member of the Kingston Trio. He helped usher in the revival of folk music in the 60s and 70s. So describe the music scene back in the 70s and 80s and how you came to play with Jon. You sort of mentioned it was this revival with the Beatles and the Byrds and what have you.
Yeah. Well, when I first started playing guitar, it was pre-Beatles. And like many, I mean, I started playing folk music, the music of the Weavers and the Kingston Trio and things like this. And then the Beatles hit when I was 13. And if you knew 3 chords and owned a guitar,
you
found
in,
2 other guys who had guitars and you played when I saw her standing there. But so I was familiar with his music. But in 1980... a mutual friend, I had moved out to Los Angeles. I was being hired by a newly formed new country label that was coming together there to be a recording artist and to be a producer for them. And literally 2 weeks before I was to leave, it collapsed. Mm. But I moved to California anyway. Yeah. And a mutual friend introduced me to John. And one, we just really hit it off. But two, I had been following his career. And after the Kingston Trio, John is one of the godfathers of what we now call Americana music. Mm. And folk rock, or whatever you want to call it then. But he had an album called California Bloodlines that is still kind of a very famous album in the singer-songwriter circles. And Lucinda Williams and Steve Earle and a lot of these people, but including one Lindsey Buckingham, who Lindsey and I are about the same age. And he learned how to play guitar to Kingston Trio records too. And one of the few rock stars who admits it. Everybody wants to say, oh no, blind melon jelly, you know?
But so John Stewart certainly had an influence on your writing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So The Girl of St. Lucie is from your recent album, Gin and Rosewater. It's the story of your parents. So tell us more about them and the pieces of their lives that you wanted to incorporate in this song.
Okay. Yeah. So my parents were Depression era kids. So my dad was born in 1920, my mother in 1923. Dad was born on a farm in Piasta, Iowa, which is right outside of Dubuque, where I was born. And went to a one-room schoolhouse from kindergarten through 12th grade, literally, and then worked his way through college and law school out in Iowa, and became a lawyer, got involved in Democratic politics, and he met a young Jack Kennedy, who was a senator from Massachusetts, and they became friends, and he worked on the 60 Kennedy campaign, and that took us to Washington, D.C. And my mom, her story was the urban version of that. She lived in an Irish Catholic part of Chicago, and both her parents had passed away by the time she was 16 and raised by her aunts, really. And she had an aunt who was a nun who got her and her sister and brother into Catholic boarding schools. And but they went on to live this incredible life. They found each other and married and had four children and lived an incredible life. And my mom, who's featured in this particular song, just really had that attitude of gratitude that carried her through some very tough times, especially early in life, but to her, literally to her dying day, that was the gift she left us.
Let's take a listen.
She sang every morning at Mass with the men from St. Lucie. Voice rang as clear as the rain, and it mimicked her beauty. Her hair shone as red as a flame. Every boy whispered her name, wanted to walk to the game with the girl from St. Lucie. Grew up a fatherless child, but she never felt lonely. The laughter pealed playful and wild from the girl's dormitory. While praising the incarnate word, the Irish nuns gathered their skirts, dancing the jig that delighted the girl from St. Lucie. And she said, it's all right now, it's all right now, no matter what night brings, morning holds everything, everything. That night at the Normandy Inn sat the man from Piasta. He asked for her hand and he promised his love would not cost her. He spoke of a home in Dubuque, And the ring that he offered as proof meant life would be much short-lived with the girl from St. Lucie. They became husband and wife for Duane, Indiana. They loaded their worldly possessions in his blue Impala. They set off upon their own track. They never once thought to look back. Traveling 10 million miles from the steps of St. Lucie. She said, it's all right now. It's all right now. No matter what night brings, morning holds everything, everything.
You, as we mentioned, had an illustrious career in politics for 30 years. So what motivated the political career?
I grew up around politics in that, as I mentioned, my dad became a member of the Kennedy administration, and that brought us to Washington from Little Dubuque, Iowa. And, you know, we went into the parochial schools in the D.C. suburbs, and my classmates were the children of senators or newscasters, or, I mean, it's an industry town, mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. And as like an eighth grader, I became friends with one Joe Kennedy, who was Robert Kennedy's oldest son. And we became very, very close. And I spent a lot of time with his family and ski trips and river trips and worked summer jobs working in his father's Senate office, mm-hmm. and things like that. And I assumed in those days, my high school days, that I'd go to college and law school like my father had, and which both my brothers eventually did, and maybe work, you know, on Capitol Hill for a while or something. And but after 1968, when we lost Robert Kennedy and lost Martin Luther King and the Vietnam War waging, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash made more sense to me than Richard Nixon did. Mm-hmm. And I left that behind. But then after, about 14 years playing music, two things happened. One, I was now married and we were expecting our first child. And Joe had started something called Citizens Energy Corporation back here in Boston. And he kept calling me and offering me the opportunity to come back and work.
I need a job.
With him, a real job. And with impending fatherhood and whatnot. And quite frankly, Mindy, you know, I have so many great memories from that 14-year period. And nothing's better than a great gig. But there's a lot of slugging through the bars.
Sure.
And my kind of music wasn't current at the time. It was the Go-Go's and Flock of Seagulls and, you know, stuff like this. So I said, I'm ready to try something else. And my wife was excited by the prospect of that stability. And we moved from Los Angeles back to Boston. And so that's what I thought I'd be doing. That was the energy company, mm-hmm. and this electricity trading operation that we began. Then Tip O'Neill retired. Joe decided to run for his seat. I became the campaign director of that campaign. Shockingly, a Kennedy won in Massachusetts, and I went with him to Washington. And so that's what got me going.
Got the ball rolling. Now, music was still part of your life, though, even though you weren't doing it for a living. You never stopped playing.
I never stopped playing. I never stopped writing songs. Yeah. I mean,
one of the biggest environmental challenges that we have to date is climate change.
Yes.
Yet we're seeing climate change science politicized. So what are your thoughts on how we got to this place and how we can help move toward a political consensus on climate change?
Yeah, another really good set of questions. You know, I think we got to this point. It's very similar to the political and public perception and awareness struggle we had around tobacco, right? Tobacco shortens your life. Tobacco consumption does, especially smoking it. But it was a big business. And that the status quo, the tobacco companies, did a lot to cast doubt on the emerging science on the health effects of smoking tobacco. And that delayed meaningful reforms in that regard. Same thing is happening around hydrocarbons. You know, the large, extraction companies, whether it be coal, gas, oil, they're big businesses. They still have a lot of their wealth is still underground, and they want the opportunity to get it out and reward their shareholders and all those kind of things. So they cast doubt on the science, and they have enough political influence in Washington, unfortunately, still, that they're able to at least slow these things down. I think it's the great moral outrage of our time. I mean, you and I have lived through the civil rights struggle and things that were globally, whether it be South Africa or here in the United States and elsewhere. And the number of people who will be affected by this, if it really goes as badly as it could, dwarfs any other regional conflict or anything else. So I think that's how we got there. And we're the laggards. I mean, the rest of the industrialized world is much more prepared to deal with this. Where do we go from here, I think, is what everybody's trying to figure out. And I've been working on this climate thing in one way or another for over 30 years. But for a long time, we were waiting for a champion, you know, the Nelson Mandela of the climate issue. Maybe someone would emerge from the rainforest in Brazil, you know. But I no longer believe that. I think that, like with everything in this digital world now, it's almost micro-targeting. It's one set of messages for the 10 to 15-year-olds and another set of messages for the 15 to 21-year-olds and different ones for the 60 to 70-year-olds. And I, who's going to organize that, I don't yet know. Mm-hmm. But the science is there. It's not equivocal. The stakes could not be higher, and it worries me.
You wrote a song specifically about climate change. Do you consider it a political song?
I have certain scruples about, quote, political songs. I mean, the ones that are the most literal, they don't tend to grab me. The ones that build it into a story, so they're not beating you over the head, but the story is the message, for me, have been the ones that have been most evocative. So I chose to try to tell a story of a flood in this case and see if it doesn't make the point.
All right, let's give a listen. This is Hold Back the Water from Chuck McDermott's latest album, Gin and Rosemary.
Oh, Lord, gotta hold back the water. Gotta hold back the water. Oh Lord, gotta hold back the water. Oh Lord, gotta hold back the water. I can see the Red Creek rise. It's where it swells before my eyes. I can see the Red Creek rise.
There's no going yesterday.
Thunder clouds are turning black, like a sack of coal on a devil's back. Thunder clouds are turning black.
Belvedere is another cut from your recent album. Its tone is kind of melancholy. So tell us a bit more about what you were feeling when you wrote this song.
Yeah, so this song I wrote probably 1982. And most of the songs on the record I had written in the last 2 or 3 years, but I worked with a wonderful producer named Lauren Entress on this, and he said, give me as much as you got of your original stuff. So I gave him probably 40 songs, including things that went back to that era. That was my Jon Stewart era. He picked a couple things. He picked one from the 70s and one from the 80s, and this is the one from the 80s. Now, this is, it's a song of lost love, if you will, and I consider myself a storyteller type of writer primarily, although this one is not so much that. This is more imagery. I was trying to see if I could get the tale told in a little bit more impressionistic way.
All the blood behind the dam, all the feeling in my hands, all the light your eyes can stand, you'll find here in Belvedere. Tiny teardrops on my face, cut across my cheeks like lace, feeling arms you can't embrace. That's the fear in Belvedere. Oh, she really found a man in me, and she really made the most of me, and she really made it hard for me. She let me stand here outside Belvedere.
Stills and Nash come to mind. You mentioned them earlier. Also has kind of that, as you were mentioning, classic country feel to it. This tune is, it's not country music that we hear played on the radio today. It's so how would you describe that difference between the pop country of today and the more classic music of Chuck McDermott, Merle Haggard, or Hank Williams?
Okay. Thank you for lumping me in with my heroes. Well, I think there's a big gulf between what I'd call the classic country music that sort of I first fell so deeply in love with, and today's contemporary country music. I'm saddened that country music's gotten so big. That's wonderful on the one hand, but as can happen, it's now really done by formula. A lot of these songs could be written by computer, literally, and you know the singers are excellent singers, the players are excellent players. But it doesn't have the beating heart that, or even the humor, you know, that you found in the classic country music of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and whatnot. Mm. Now, I think my music we're calling Americana, which I'm grateful for that term because it's a Venn diagram that includes hardcore country music, bluegrass, folk, rhythm and blues, you know, American roots music traditions, all put in a stew and mm-hmm. stirred up together. And it honors the role of the songwriter. And that's one thing Nashville always did do. They honored songwriters.
Bluebird Cafe.
The Bluebird Cafe. Yeah, and that's still, yeah, you know, a powerful thing there. I'm grateful for the emergence of the genre Americana, which is, call it, a middle ground between that. And there's still a place. There are revivalists mm-hmm. who Dwight Yoakam's a good example mm-hmm. and things. And he's wonderful, mm-hmm. you know, and he's very true to that Bakersfield, Buck Owens, Merle Haggard type sound from the primarily from the 60s and stuff. And he puts his own spin on it. And But I've given myself permission, and some of this came from my years working with Jon Stewart and being exposed to Lindsey Buckingham and other people, to widen the aperture a little bit on groove and subject matter and instrumentation and things like that, and just see what happens.
We're going to go out on the second track from your new record. This is titled A Thousand Cuts. Anything you want to say about it before we hear it?
The thought here, this is when I was driving in the car thinking, you know, I should try to write a song about this. But all the ways in which we can inadvertently or carelessly kind of hurt the people we care about. You always hurt the one you love, you know, the Mills Brothers. But, you know, sometimes it's something frivolous and sometimes it's something grave. And so I tried to just throw out a bunch of examples of that and put it to a peppy beat for some reason.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. Really enjoyed talking with you.
Oh, thank you.
Chuck McDermott's new album is Gin and Rose Water. He'll be performing in Dennisport on Saturday, November 18th. We'll have more information at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Maybe it's the price of the fight. Sometimes wrong, sometimes right. Sometimes dark, sometimes light. I heard her when my grip became loose. I heard her when the spark became flame. I heard her.